All right, listeners, welcome to episode 68 of Know Your Enemy. I'm your podcast co-host, Matt Sittman, and I'm not here with my great friend, Sam Etherbell. He's traveling with family, so I'm recording a quick introduction for this episode, which we're very excited to share with you. This one's a little different. We had on our producer, Jesse Brenneman, out from behind the soundboard, grabbing the third mic, and we have a long conversation about a really incredible TV show from the 90s called Walker, Texas Ranger. It played for 8 seasons on CBS. It starred Chuck Norris, the great Chuck Norris, who also was its executive producer. And it's been a longtime obsession of Jesse's, but it's also a great window into, well, the zeitgeist of America in the 90s, but especially what a show based in Texas, a crime drama, a crime action show, I should really say, you know, what kind of insights can be gleaned about law and order politics, the American right, politics in the 90s, the issues that were percolating. A lot of them resonate with us still here today. Stranger danger, satanic panics, child trafficking, drugs, crime, law and order, all that's here, but in a slightly different form. So we talk about conservatism in the 90s, the kind of politics of this show that was popular. It was a top 20, top 25 show for a couple of years. So we had a lot of fun with this. And unlike some of our episodes, there's actually a lot of great sound clips that Jesse edited in. So you get a flavor for the universe of Walker, Texas Ranger. But before we get to that, I just have a few housekeeping items. As always, we're grateful to our partners at Dissent for sponsoring the podcast. We love working with them, and we encourage all of you to check them out. One thing they do for us is if you subscribe to Know Your Enemy at patreon.com/knowyourenemy for $10 a month, not only do you get access to all of our bonus episodes, but Dissent will give you a free digital subscription to their magazine. For $5 a month, of course, you get access to all of our bonus episodes. And as always, we want to thank Jesse Brenneman, our producer, the star of today's episode, and of course, Will Epstein, who does the music for the show under the moniker High Water. Here's the episode on Walker, Texas Ranger. Enjoy. All right, let's get started. Jesse Brenneman, our amazing producer. It feels strange to say welcome back to the podcast because you're always in some sense on the podcast, but welcome back to the third mic.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. You know, when you look down and there was only one pair of footprints, I was carrying both of you.
I feel like the eyes of our producer are always behind us.
The eyes of the producer are upon you. Any wrong you do, I'm going to see.
That's what I meant.
That's very good close reading, Sam. I can tell that you did, in fact, watch the episodes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. So why don't we just go ahead and say what our topic is today. It's one I'm incredibly excited to talk about. It might be a little different for listeners.
Yeah, I did start watching the first episode and then go, what the fuck is Jesse putting us through? Why is this a Know Your Enemy episode? But then it became clear over time.
Yes, exactly. This is the long-awaited Walker, Texas Ranger episode. I mean, really, as soon as we did the very first Know Your Enemy film club, this was inevitable. For me, as conservative media, it is as good as it gets because it is just so unself-aware.
I think a word you used in one of our text exchanges when I was watching it was guileless. It's this profoundly guileless show.
Yeah, I love it so much.
Well, Jesse, since you're the real Walker, Texas Ranger obsessive among us, tell us a little more about it, how you got into it, or why all these years later you're still kind of thinking about it.
Well, anyone who listened to the past movie episodes know I do just like watching bad stuff. And Walker is, you know, some of the worst. My way into Walker was kind of the way into a lot of things, which was through my mom, who I like to make fun of things with. We just would laugh at how funny they were. Because, I mean, we'll get to this in the episodes. They're nuts. These episodes are nuts. You couldn't make something funnier, in my opinion, if you tried, than a lot of Walker episodes, when they try to be perfectly serious. And I didn't think about Walker for quite a while until my sister had her accident and she was in the hospital and we were staying at a friend's house and my friend had his TV hooked up to the antenna. And if you get like the free stations that come with the digital antenna, there's always a station called, usually it'll be like Man TV, Manhood TV, Remember the Good Old Days TV. In this case, it was Grit TV, some station that plays old John Wayne movies, ads for like hernia mesh surgery lawsuits and catheters, and then episodes of Walker, Texas Ranger. And when my sister was in the hospital, I came home one day and turned on the TV and Walker was on. And it'd be very tidy to say the moral clarity of Walker was so comforting in a time of uncertainty. But no, it was just so fucking stupid that it was such a respite from being at the hospital with my sister in the ICU. And it just made me laugh like I had never laughed before, it felt like. And that was 2017. And then I got back in with a vengeance. And of course, you can't really stream episodes very easily. So my friends bought me the DVD box set. That's my personal Walker connection.
Well, I'll tell you that my main relationship to Walker, Texas Ranger was not actually watching the show, but I was a big fan as a kid of Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
And in like 2004, I think, when NBC and Universal merged, the joke was that he got access to the archives of the show.
The Walker lever.
Yes. And so during the show at any time, he could pull this lever behind his desk that would show a completely contextless clip from Walker, Texas Ranger. And they were always just kind of like bewildering.
And how you doing, little partner?
Walker told me I have AIDS.
So my association with the show was as this kind of like adolescent sense memory of this like almost fugue-like nonsense world that would be interjected into my favorite absurdist late-night talk show.
Yeah. I will say, you know, it's not that the Conan Walker lever is unrepresentative, because, of course, those moments are just as absurd as they seem. But in my opinion, it's even richer taken in context, because, like, what you don't realize is that the whole 42-minute episode is that the whole time. Like, it's not a normal show that has these weird moments. It's deranged, and it's structurally deranged, like in its very bones, not just in these like moments.
I experienced it a little differently than Sam. I experienced Walker, Texas Ranger in real time in the 90s as a adolescent because my mother loved it. Mm. My mother just loved Walker, Texas Ranger. It's funny, my father, there's a few shows my mom watched where my dad would tease her that she was like madly in love with the male lead. So during the period of time in the 90s when she, you know, regularly watched Walker, Texas Ranger, it would be Chuck Norris jokes.
Yeah.
But, you know, the kind of surreal quality of it wasn't what impressed itself upon me. It was the kind of moral clarity.
Yeah.
You know, of Walker, Chuck Norris being on the side of the angels,
yeah,
you know, kind of fighting corruption, bad people. It's not a show with a lot of kind of moral ambiguity, I think it'd be fair to say.
Well, there's moral confusion, I would say, but there's no, everything makes perfect sense in the mind of the show. I mean, it doesn't make any sense outside of that bubble, but the show couldn't be more clear on what is right and wrong.
Yes.
At all times.
That struck me immediately when I started watching the episodes. This is so profoundly pre-anti-hero television.
Yes.
It's not like there's a morally ambiguous anti-hero who we like despite themselves. Like, it's all about the good guys are unimpeachably good, and the bad guys, whether they're like a petty criminal who like shoplifts or like a school teacher who sells drugs, like they are on the brink of doing mass murder at all times.
And they do it because it's fun. They love to do crime.
Yes.
One of the big notes I made as I was rewatching these episodes, I wrote that it's a righteous and confident conservatism. There's no cleverness. There's no feigned ignorance or playing of different angles. You know, there's none of the online stuff we see now, which is like, well, we only did this because you made us do it. Or, we don't really believe that. You know, there's none of the like 12-dimensional chess of how can we make ourselves look good. It just knows that it is good.
And it did strike me as like a different era of conservatism. You know, it's between the end of the Cold War and 9/11, basically.
Yep.
The reason I think it's so good for this show is I actually think that it bridges two periods of conservatism. It starts in 93, and those early seasons are fairly staid. There is for Walker quite a bit more nuance. It's a comparatively straightforward law and order conservatism. I mean, you know, like it's Texas and the good old boys, but there's also episodes about racism that are surprisingly not terrible. To roughly gloss it, it feels like respectable, compassionate, quote unquote, conservatism.
Honesty and decency.
It's a like stoical, moral version of an idealized concept of manhood.
And I think that that moral line never changes for the character of Walker or for the show. But what does change in the show is, if we're talking about 93, the show starts. By 96, by season 3, things are taking a turn. And I'm just making observations here. I can't say that anyone has ever attested to any of this, but, you know, we're talking about by now the Gingrich and this whole new Republican relationship to Democrats is sort of forming. And you don't see that literally in the show, but the show just goes into the stratosphere as the seasons go on. What I always say is that, like, in season one, Walker is an incorruptible cop. By season six, he is Christ the Messiah. I mean, almost literally. Like, he becomes an infallible, magical being.
Yeah.
And the show goes from being, you know, it's always pretty bonkers, and I don't want to say there's nothing weird in the early seasons, but as the show goes into the 90s, the themes include Satanism, sex trafficking, magic and spirituality. There's an episode about a child who has psychic powers and is being locked up by an evil corporation, and his best friend is a computer who talks to him. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say the arc of the conservatism of the show is confident conservatism to paranoid conservatism.
Yes, right.
And by the end of the show, it is just like, the bad guys are out there. They're crazy. They're psychos. They're sick, and they love to do murder, and also maybe they're witches, and they're going to sex traffic you. Maybe the Yakuza is involved.
Yeah, there's something maybe about how the conservative patriarchal confidence in the sufficiency of just simple values of manhood, thrift, loyalty, and generosity somehow ceased to be satisfying for conservatives themselves at some point in the 1990s.
Yes.
And therefore, they have to create like a sort of existential, literally Satanist enemy in order for conservative values to seem like vital again.
Yeah. And I think not acknowledging the contradictions of the worldview, but sort of acknowledging that for all of their upstanding moral righteousness, the world still doesn't quite make sense. How do we explain all the things that are going on in the world while also making sure we don't actually explain them?
Sure.
You know, like how do we explain the fact that the world really is quite simple? It's all very easy. You know, like if a kid's having trouble, he just needs to run some laps or maybe like do kickboxing. The show is convinced of that fact. How do you square that with the fact that obviously the world is not getting better in their eyes? And it's like, well, maybe it's drugs, Satan, gangbangers, as they like to say a lot.
Yeah, and the show was incredibly popular.
Yeah.
We had more and more viewers as it ran. By the end, I guess it was drawing like 10 million viewers a week. So I think we have a right to interpret this as a sort of urtext of the American psyche during the period it was airing.
I think so, without a doubt.
Okay, good.
Maybe we should just talk about some of like when the show aired, who was on it, that kind of thing. It was 8 full seasons between 1993 and 2001. And as we mentioned, it's starring Chuck Norris, who is one of the executive producers, along with his younger brother, Aaron.
And Chuck Norris... you know, who was Chuck Norris as a cultural figure when he started starring in this show? I mean, my impression is basically he was like a martial arts instructor in Hollywood who then was in like a Bruce Lee movie that kind of blew him up.
Yes. And he wasn't born Chuck Norris. His full name is Carlos Ray Norris, born in March 1940 in Ryan, Oklahoma. He was in the Air Force, was really into martial arts. And it was the Bruce Lee 1972's The Way of the Dragon. I guess he played a villain in it. And that was kind of what took him from mostly being like a guy with a martial arts studio who had been in the Air Force. And, you know, he did competitions. I mean, he has a bunch of black belts. Like, he is an accomplished martial arts figure. But yeah, and then by the time we get to like 1990, he'd done all these action films in the 70s and 80s. And his films, they'd grossed like $500 million over the course of those couple of decades. So he did actually, you know, put some asses in seats and had some at least relatively successful films that made money in this period.
You know, I think the interesting thing about Chuck Norris is that he's really, really uncharismatic.
Yeah.
You know, Jean-Claude Van Damme is so swaggering. Chuck Norris has a robotic quality. And like, I mean, you see this in Walker. He doesn't like acting. It's pretty clear. He's not good at it. He doesn't like saying lines. He really, really likes fighting. And so he had a lot of these big hit movies, but he doesn't have the charisma of like a sex symbol.
Matt's mom would beg to disagree.
I mean, he's got the rugged, you know, austere, that side of the masculinity.
He has just a very kind of soft kind of presence on screen. He speaks pretty softly. His smile is kind of sheepish. There's no double entendre.
No.
His sort of bearing is like, he really doesn't like show off his virility or sexiness for the camera at all.
And by the time Walker came along, he was in his 50s, which I think is notable too, that he was kind of, you know, he'd gone through his phase of doing these big movies, including Lone Wolf McQuade, which was a movie from 1983. Uh-huh.
That was the one with David Carradine as his antagonist?
Yeah, and he plays a Texas Ranger named Lone Wolf McQuade, and it's basically the proto-Walker setup.
I want to say a little bit about Norris's political interventions.
Sure.
And profile. But you know what? I think kind of like as a lead into that, you know, he has his own martial arts system now called the Chuck Norris system. And I saw like his 10 rules for like a code of honor to like live by, his personal code. There are things like, I will develop myself to the maximum of my potential in all ways. I will look for the good in all people and make them feel worthwhile. I will maintain respect for those in authority and demonstrate this respect at all times. I will always remain loyal to my God, my country, family, and friends. I won't read all 10. But I kind of think, you know, you can see this is kind of like a personally conservative code that's definitely expressed in the show. But like, I think kind of in later years after Walker had ended and, you know, we're in the post 9/11 phase of American politics, Chuck Norris was pretty explicitly a Republican and has endorsed various candidates running for office, especially like in GOP primaries. He's written books, one called Black Belt Patriotism, which is like his How to Reinvigorate America book, that kind of thing. So he's definitely like a conservative figure. So if anyone's listening, why are we talking about Chuck Norris? Walker, Texas Ranger, it's a very, I think, emblematic of a certain aspect of the 90s.
Yeah.
But also Chuck Norris is one of these kind of strange Republican celebrities, right? Like James Wood or John Voight or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about maybe some of the episodes we watched.
I do want to note, the song that opens every episode is kind of great.
Oh, it's so good.
And Chuck Norris himself actually sings the song.
Yeah, I mean, sings in the sort of Brechtian speak-sing style.
In the eyes of a ranger, the unsuspecting stranger had better know the truth of wrong from right. 'Cause the eyes of the ranger are upon you. Any wrong you do, gonna see when you're in Texas, look behind you, 'cause that's where the ranger's gonna be.
There's basically four main characters, and we've mentioned one of them, the character played by Chuck Norris, Cordell Walker. He's a Texas Ranger, former Marine. And Jesse, maybe tell us a little bit more about this character's backstory.
I mean, Walker is the greatest man that can live. He is half Cherokee. His dad was full Native, and his dad was actually killed in front of a young Walker by white supremacists at a carnival.
Yep.
And Walker takes on white supremacists quite a number of times over the course of the show. And that means that his character, in addition to being a really good cop and a great martial artist, is also extremely spiritual. Anytime he walks onto a reservation or into a group of Native people, they all immediately respect him. And he can commune with Native spirits sometimes.
Walker, where's all this coming from? How do you know it's a boy? How do you know he was murdered?
Because I saw a young Indian boy on a white pony.
Okay, where is he? Where'd he go?
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Try me.
He rode right through these rocks.
I don't believe you.
I know.
And of course, he's dating Alex, the district attorney.
Alex Cahill, the district attorney, played by Cherie Wilson, who'd been on Dallas. And her and Walker, they're romantic interests. At times, in some of the early episodes we watch, it wasn't clear. By the end, I think they're engaged.
They do get married eventually. They're dating for most of the show. Part of why it's not clear is that, like, Chuck Norris seems so physically uncomfortable around her.
Yeah.
They have the most chaste, good Christian, don't touch each other relationship imaginable. Again, I think in the early seasons, there's a little more realism to their relationship. But by season 3 or 4 or 5, the joke is kind of that he doesn't want to have to hang out with his girlfriend, which just kind of plays into the like 12-year-old mindset of the show.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's a district attorney.
Since Walker, you know, is a Texas Ranger, he's getting things like arrest warrants, right? And handling evidence.
What do you have on him?
Right now, it's the victim's word against his.
What about DNA tests?
We should have the results back in about a week to 10 days.
That'll be too late. Can you hurry it up?
Sure.
Can you do me another favor? Can you contact the judge and see if he'll lower the bail?
Walker, this is a very serious charge.
Yeah, but the kid deserves a break.
All right, I'll see what I can do.
Okay, thanks.
On the face of it, there's an extraordinary amount of corruption going on between the Texas Rangers and the DA's office, because he's dating her and asking her for favors constantly on behalf of certain criminals and getting her to, you know, throw the book at those that he deems to be pure evil, as he often does.
Well, Walker is the law, so if he does it, it is by definition correct.
So who are the other characters?
Cordell Walker's partner, James Trevett, who is a former football player. He's an African-American and played by Clarence Gilliard.
He is a very good Texas Ranger, too. He's also incorruptible. He's also a very, very good fighter. And crucially, he's the butt of the jokes. That kind of starts with gentle ribbing and them having, like, attempted banter, which, you know, Chuck Norris can't banter any better than he can flirt. He just seems like he wants to crawl into a cave.
It's kind of funny because Trevette sort of plays the straight man to Walker, but Walker's already so straight. They're all the most boring people of all time, you know?
The best example of that is, and we'll get to it, but the episode The Principal, there's like a 2-minute sequence that has nothing to do with anything that is just Trevette saying he wants to get a dog and all the other characters just piling on him, being like, you're stupid. Why would you want a dog?
Why don't you go on a date?
What's wrong with me getting a dog?
You're never home. It just wouldn't be fair to the animal.
It's cruel.
This whole dog business is just a classic case of avoidance. I know dating is tough, but...
Jimmy, you're more like a cat man.
Fine, I'll just get a goldfish.
It has nothing to do with anything, but the show is just like, when there's downtime, they should basically be humiliating Trevette.
Or like the time Walker suggested that Halloween costume.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course.
Boxers with hearts on them.
From Lethal Weapon.
From Lethal Weapon, yeah. And flapping his arms around like a chicken.
Yeah.
And Walker's like, you'll be guaranteed to win the prize for best costume if you do this.
Yeah.
And it's just very strange.
It's all so strange. And I think it's also Trevette is a really good symbol for how the show changes because, I mean, Trevette's black, obviously. And one of the episodes I almost picked for us from season 2, I think, there's an episode where they go to a southern Texas town that is run by a crooked sheriff. And the sheriff is a racist, and the sheriff and his cronies just harass any non-white people in the town. And yeah. Walker goes down and they find out about it. Trevette ends up like intervening on behalf of this other black family. And it's actually pretty good when it comes to the issue. You know, I mean, it basically says, yeah, there are these corrupt sheriffs out there and sometimes they're racist and Walker is super pissed about that. And crucially, there is a scene where Trevette says to Walker, and this is unthinkable in the later seasons, Trevette says to Walker, you might understand it intellectually, but you'll never understand it the way I do because I have to live it. And yeah. We have to set that against a scene from season 6 or 7 where Walker says to Trevette about a native issue, white man's rules don't apply here, Trevette. And Trevette says, I'm not white, Walker. And Walker says, well, you dance like it.
Oh my goodness.
So like that is kind of the arc of the show, is like it goes from kind of being able to say, yes, racism is real. And guess what? It affects people of color differently than white people. And by the end of the show, it's like, actually, I, the white guy, get it more than you do. And you're basically white compared to me.
The fourth main character is C.D.
C.D. Parker.
You were Walker's partner years ago when he joined the Rangers. Isn't that true, Mr. Parker?
Yes. Cordell Walker is one of the finest men to ever wear a Rangers badge. And when he goes after his man, he gets it. And we're going to get these psychopaths, and they're going to die.
Anything else to add?
Just to the psychos. Your days are numbered. Cordell Walker will get you.
I was waiting for him at some point to kind of break the fourth wall, look at the camera, and talk about diabetes.
Exactly. Played by Noble Willingham, who is a bit of a lookalike of Wilford Brimley. He's your classic folksy, down-home, mustachioed cowboy man.
Former Ranger, now owner of the bar they hang out at, but don't drink at.
Well, no, they drink coffee. Walker drinks coffee at the bar. Like Alex, he gets beat up when the plot calls for someone to get beat up.
The women and the old.
And occasionally he also provides this old-fashioned sounding board where he'll be like, we wouldn't have needed a trial when I was a Ranger.
So those are our four main characters. Jesse, do you want to lead us into the first episode?
You very carefully selected 4 episodes for us to watch, which I admit, I mean, you did a hell of a job. They were 4 perfect episodes.
Yeah, where do you want to start?
I think we could talk about the earliest one, The Brotherhood with the Crooked Cops, yeah. Because that one is pretty rich.
There ain't going to be any room left for good people unless somebody does something about the scuzzoids that are ruining this world. Nobody seems to be willing to step up to the plate, but I am. And screw anybody who gets in my way.
The plot of The Brotherhood from season four is that there are some cops in another district in Texas who Walker and Trivette deduce are doing extrajudicial killings.
Spoke to Sergeant Ross. He says you're bent out of shape because someone's taking out bad guys.
I guess you could say I'm a little bent.
Specifically, they're killing people who got out of jail.
Either early or off on a technicality, quote-unquote technicality.
Look at this. You remember Milo Creech, the loan shark?
Mm-hmm.
Just last week, he beat an assault with a deadly weapon on a technicality. 3 days later, somebody threw him off a roof and killed him, right? 2 weeks before that, some guy named Jefferson Brady.
The kiddie porn guy?
Yeah, yeah. His case was dismissed on a technicality, and 3 days later, somebody gunned him down outside his office.
Some jibes at liberal judges.
If liberal judges would do their jobs and put these crazies where they belong. Come on, Walker. This country is tired of hiding behind locked doors.
Importantly, jibes at liberal judges by the villains of the episode.
Yes, exactly.
And this is, I think, what makes this episode so interesting. This is a great example of the needle that Walker threads, which is like, Walker has to restore order. Cops can't be going around killing people extrajudicially. But the show, as a show, is quite sympathetic to the complaint of the murderers.
Yeah.
Like, the show does basically say these people, which it stresses, are murderers, rapists, and pedophiles.
Look at that, gentlemen. That's a list of all the murderers, rapists, and pedophiles released by Dallas courts in the last week.
Will you look at that?
They should die, basically, but they should die legally. Or at Walker's hand.
I mean, I do think what you're getting at, Jesse, with Walker kind of being the enforcer of the law, so he despises people who go around it to violate it, unless it's him. He's the exception and the rule, right? Like, this is what we talked about when we had Gans on to talk about the sheriff's initiatives at the Claremont Institute and what they're trying to teach county-level sheriffs about how to think of themselves. They are the enforcers of the law and those empowered in dire enough circumstances to violate the law to protect it.
Yes, Sam, I had the exact same experience. My mind did go to the Claremont episode with Gans because there was a moment where the bad cops who are doing these kind of executions, one of them says,
"We became policemen because we believed it was a calling, not just a job. That's why we joined the force. That's why Horn had to take the law into his own hands. You see, Foster, we are answering to a higher call now."
They know what justice really is, right? And in the cases where it's not served by the judicial system, they, you know, are still serving that higher calling by taking it into their own hands.
I also think there is strong reinforcement of the conservative interest in hierarchy, which is to say, there are people who can break the rules. You, just some random cop, can't do it.
This might be a place to say, like, what is the Texas Rangers? Texas Rangers is like a state-level investigative agency of the state of Texas, right?
They're FBI, kind of.
It's like a state-level FBI, but it's especially chartered in Texas. There isn't really, like, an exact analog to it in every state.
It has these kind of deep roots in Texas history, going back to when Texas was a republic, and now they have, I think they have a kind of interesting legal status, is like they can't be disbanded, I read, like legally. And it kind of, in the show, it sort of has this like who's watching the watchers vibe.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Like the normal cops, but then they're the Texas Rangers.
Well, they're super cops.
And then the FBI comes in sometimes too, and they're like the outside federal government. You're a little suspicious of them. There's a moment in one of the episodes where Alex is hesitant to give over a case to the FBI because the federal government can't do executions.
I almost hate to turn it over to them. There is no federal death penalty.
Let us nail Openshaw on this kidnapping murder, and then you can take your time tying him to the massacres. And we'll send him back to Texas on 13 counts of murder. Don't worry, Miss Cahill. You'll get your justice.
So I think you're right that the Rangers sort of occupy this watching the watchers over and above and in between all kinds of law enforcement authority. It's worth saying about their history that during the sort of era of like the Mexican Revolution and vigilante violence against the Tejano population in Texas, the Rangers were explicitly allied with vigilante violence against Mexican people in Texas, people of Mexican descent. They were a part of basically a massacre, genocidal massacre. So for the Rangers to represent in this episode, the anti-vigilante, pro-law and order impulse is a bit ironic given the history of the Rangers.
I wanted to add to that, Rick Perry, remember him, former governor of Texas? Back in 2010, he gave the Norris brothers, he named them honorary Texas Ranger captains for the work on the series.
Amazing.
But I thought this was so fascinating because it's this weird moment where, like, he kind of says the quiet part out loud. In his speech, Rick Perry said that together, meaning the Norris brothers, they helped elevate our Texas Rangers to truly mythical status.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was like, that's shockingly apropos. Like, he said, like, this show made the Texas Rangers into this fantastical, idealistic, again, super cops, and the kind of reality Sam was describing. They literally are choosing myth over those.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Totally. Yeah. There's a fascinating episode that I almost picked where a company is polluting the river on a Native reservation. And Native children are dying from this pollution. The factory is covering it up. The government is incompetent in catching them. Walker is called in to investigate. And crucially, there is a group of young Native guys who are doing vigilante warfare against the company. And the show can't help but depict them heroically, saying this is good that you're doing this. But it also has to really drive home the point that Walker has to basically come in and be the dad and say, I know you want to do this. You're right to want to do it, but you can't do it. It's not okay. And sure enough, one of the guys who does the vigilante justice gets killed. And the lesson is kind of like, yes, I understand why you're upset, but you do have to defer to Walker.
I mean, the importance of Walker's history there is crucial because basically the message is Walker has successfully sublimated his rage against the people who killed his family in front of him into using the power vested in him by the state to do violence. But if you don't do that, then that's too far.
All that is to say that, like, vigilanteism is a really interesting thing in the show. And I think the show itself is quite conflicted about it. And the way that it threads that needle in this Brotherhood episode is it really leans on the idea that if you do vigilante justice, you're going to make a mistake and kill an innocent person.
As they do in this episode.
Yeah, they end up killing a guy who's wrongfully accused. It kind of implies that all the other people they were killing, fair enough.
Yes, exactly. That was where I was like, oh, this is the line for Walker. Because, you know, you kind of think you're watching this and you're like, oh, this is interesting. Like, so the focus of this show is that they're going to go after these bad cops, these evil cops who kill people, who do extrajudicial murder. But then when there's the showdown, the conversation between Walker and the sort of leader of this cabal of killer cops, what becomes clear is that Walker's objection is that you might one day kill someone innocent. This is already after these guys have blown up with a remote bomb an entire bus full of people getting off on early release, which means that they served their time in prison, and we don't even know what all of them did. No. They all get killed. Also, the guy driving the bus gets burned to a crisp.
They burn like 30 people alive.
But when the sort of leader of the killer cops says to Walker, you know, who cares?
Whoever did this killed two arms dealers and a busload of early releases.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just don't feel any great sense of loss here.
Walker's response is,
what happens when they make a mistake and kill an innocent person? What happens when they kill the people they're paid to protect?
For every innocent person, 100 bad guys go down.
Sounds like lousy odds to me.
So there's one person who gets killed who happens to be the child of a friend of Walker's.
Yes.
I said it would happen.
What the hell are you talking about?
I said one day an innocent person would be killed. And now one has. Ernesto Lopez. And you can tell whoever did it. I'm coming after him.
He's Latino.
Latino, falsely accused of raping a white girl. And gets off because of a DNA test.
Yeah.
And I want to add, just to give listeners a flavor for some of the madness of the show, one of the things I noticed about this episode is kind of nested within all the plot strands we've been talking about. The Latino kid we've just described, who's falsely accused, he has this long black veil sort of
exactly
country song, you know, alibi where he's dating a congressman's daughter.
Yeah.
And the congressman does not approve of her dating him. And so tied up in his original arrest and everything was he didn't give the alibi that he actually wasn't there because of this. And that plot line is just kind of drop then?
We never see her and we never see the congressman.
So, like, why is it a congressman?
It did seem to me like what partially is being implied there is that Walker is also on the side of people who are on the up, you know, people
yes,
who are
yes, yes, yes.
are poor but becoming better, or former criminals.
Getting their life together.
Yeah, getting their life together.
Exactly.
This kid was in a gang, a gangbanger, as they always say on the show. He got out of that, then yep. he joined the military, and he came home, and he's making something of his life.
It's my oldest boy, Ernesto. He's in trouble.
Trouble? Tommy told me he joined the Marines, and he was doing great.
Yes, he was doing
And
fine.
The kind of prejudice against people who were formally criminalized or criminals or formerly dirt poor is something that is also Walker's enemy. He's opposed uh-huh. to that kind of thing. And as long as people are trying to lift themselves up and do right and do better, they're on the side of justice and God.
Walker is big hand up, not a handout energy. That is like, yeah. that is one of the major through lines of the show. The best thing you can be in Walker is a person who gave up gangbanging to get your GED or whatever.
And then get killed for an emotional blow at some point later in a later season.
And it's so gross because they build this character up and then they just like shoot him in the street.
I have to say, though, the scene between Walker and the mother, when she's so devastated, she's just saying, you know,
he survived the gangs and he survived the drive-by and then he joined the United States Marines. I thought everything was gonna be okay. Yeah. Can you tell me why? Senor Walker, can you tell me why my Ernesto had to die? I don't know. Can you just tell me why?
But the thing I was thinking while I was watching is like, this is a show about cops using violence for righteousness, right? Like, that's yeah. what the show is about. And it's kind of incredible that that there's a scene in this show where you see the consequences of that on an individual, this mother, whose child was killed by cops. I mean, they're not like fundamentally different than the Rangers. We are meant to understand them as fundamentally different because of this sort of moral universe that's so well defined in the show. But I don't know, how is this woman still going to trust Walker? You know, like, why would you ever go back to trusting the state in its capacity to do violence after your son has done everything that was asked of him and still gets killed in the street by a person in a uniform?
I wanted to make one more comment about this episode, something I'd written down, because I think it gets to something we had described earlier, which is Chuck Norris's acting and kind of some of his dialogue lines given to him. It's early in the show. Walker has the amazing line where he says,
"Just remember one thing. A clerical error on your death certificate won't mean you're still alive."
It's like it's almost a great burn.
He can't deliver it.
He can't really deliver it. Like, if he just put a little more oomph behind it, could have really hit home. Let's move on to the yep. next episode. I mean, for the listeners, this one gets resolved. There's a shootout in a graveyard where, of course, Walker manages to kill everybody. Should we move on to the Children of Halloween episode?
Since when are the Texas Rangers so interested in magic?
How about right now?
It is time to die.
So the next three are all from season 6. And Children of Halloween is a just really straightforward satanic panic episode. Basically, there are some Satanists. They look like goths, and they are yeah. rounding up kids to sacrifice on Halloween.
This symbol was left at the scene of each of the abductions.
Do you guys have any idea what this symbol represents? It represents the goat head. It's a symbol of sacrifice.
It's funny that, like, from the beginning, it looks like what's going on is Satanists abducting children to kill them on Halloween night. Then they get suspicious that that is actually what's going on. And then it turns out that what's actually going on is Satanists abducting children to kill them on Halloween night. There's no self-consciousness of like the satanic
no.
panic.
Yeah, what if this was all real and just amplified to the hilt?
But it's not even like, what if it was all real? It's like, of course it's all real. They appear to be Satanists. They are Satanists. Let's go kill the Satanists.
One of my favorite parts about this episode is that the show, and I think this is like one of the decisions the show makes without really thinking through the consequences of it, because the show implies that they are also maybe magic and ghosts. Like, there are multiple scenes of, like, the main scary Satanist walking up a set of stairs out of the crypt where he's keeping the kids and then disappearing on the stairs. And the show doesn't really go into it. I think I'm guessing the producers were like, it's kind of spooky when that happens. But, you know, is the world of Walker telling us that it believes that they are magic? Like, they are sorcerers?
Yeah, because Walker also reads a book about Satanist rituals and seems to be pretty convinced that it's real at some point during the episode.
Tibet, listen to this. Ritual of Ascension. Sacrifice must take place in a cemetery at exactly midnight on Halloween.
Walker, tonight is Halloween, and we must have hundreds of cemeteries.
This is a Halloween episode. It actually aired on Halloween. It's got spooky font.
There's a lot of spooky interstitial imagery of, like, old Satanist paintings or something.
This is what I was saying about where the show gets by the later seasons. You really see it in this one. By season six, the actual filmmaking of Walker becomes just gonzo. And really notably in terms of the scene transitions, it will cut from, say, a scene in the courthouse to a scene in an office. And in between, the camera will zoom back to the furthest point looking at Dallas, zoom into Dallas, turn to another building, and zoom into that building. Or occasionally, like, zoom into Walker's eye.
I just want to say one thing about the person who plays the lead Satanists. It's an actor named Eric Dellums.
You'd know their face.
Yeah, you would. They're a character actor in a bunch of movies. They do a lot of video game voiceover work, which I noticed because I'm a degenerate video gamer. But they're a black person who is really clearly queer-coded in this performance and the way that the character David Lucifer Thompson is dressed. And that just also just struck me as a kind of, like, they either do or don't know what they're doing, but they're doing it for sure.
It feels subconscious for the show almost.
Yeah.
It just depicts the character that way. And you're clearly, as an audience member, meant to think, yeah, that is the quote-unquote kind of person who would be into this stuff.
A creepy queer person.
There was definitely a sexual undercurrent in this episode that never really gets named.
Of course, because what you're drawing on for the audience is their sense that Satanists are child rapists, and maybe the gay person who works at your kid's daycare.
And or the person you saw on the street that one time.
Yeah, it all has to be, like, in the air with enough plausible deniability so that they're not actually being super crazy homophobic. But it's definitely drawing on all of the fears that would be kind of latent.
And I would say that, you know, like, sex is bad.
Oh, sex is so bad in the show.
Sex is scary. Like, Walker is chased. Walker doesn't want to touch his girlfriend, and they just sometimes hold hands and look at each other. And then it's like, maybe if you're a Satanist, you might like sex.
It's worth saying, too, that by the end of this episode, Alex Cahill, his girlfriend, has also been abducted by the Satanists. And she's depicted a bunch of times with a rag kind of around her mouth. And it's like a bondage scene, basically, of her. And I didn't think of it until we were just talking about the kind of cultural and sort of filmic inputs into this, that it has the kind of white lady abducted by natives trope going on here too, because of the way she's depicted in this sort of bondage scene, and because, you know, the Texas Rangers have to go save her from these savages.
In this episode, it's the one I mentioned earlier where Trivette, Walker's black sidekick, is talking about the Halloween costume. But we learn that, like, the previous year, he had gone as George Washington Carver.
Which they make fun of him for.
Yeah, it was both odd to make fun of him for it and kind of, like, just a peculiar random detail to include.
He's black. Remember? He's black, so he went as George Washington Carver.
And he's lame, you know?
Yeah, and like, he's lame, exactly.
But I also wanted to say that, you know, one of the first kids we see abducted is a young boy who is taking martial arts training.
Right.
Great job, Joey.
Thank you, sir.
You know, we really do want to thank you, Mr. Malloy. We were both a little concerned. He was heading in the wrong direction, but the progress Joey's made since studying with you has been incredible.
And it's not just his martial arts. I mean, his grades are up in school. He even keeps his room clean.
I thought this was a key detail, which is kind of like in the context of society going to hell, these stranger danger, satanic, abusing, child abducting Satanists, martial arts are portrayed as like the key to self-discipline. Like, that's sort of one of the themes that in the four episodes we watched, I noticed, which is just like, if you want to get your life together, start taking martial arts classes.
Or become a 400-pound man who slams his head into ice bricks.
Right.
We'll get to that.
There were a couple other things I wanted to point out about this. One thing is, and this is continuous and related to things we've been talking about, that when they go to the sort of seedy bars or...
Yes, I know what you're going to say.
The places where the bad guys hang out, which there's apparently a lot of those in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But the bad guys who are sort of... seem to be sort of like bikers and outlaws, and they're white, they often have rebel flags, Confederate flags.
Yes, in multiple episodes, too.
Confederate flag insignia is always associated with a bad guy who also always hates cops. Now, this is related both to the way in which the racial politics of the show have this kind of comforting simplicity of the 90s, we all know there's bad racists, and nobody likes racists. Nobody likes the Confederates. And that, that is a genuine nostalgia we could have for that now, because it would not be the case that a sort of fully conservative just-so story would depict Confederate nostalgics as exclusively bad racists, and certainly not cop haters. Because actually the people with the Confederate insignia are the people who are like in the vigilante groups who would go up to the cops and be like, hey, brother, we're on your side.
Right. It does genuinely believe that racism is bad. It has no concept of the fact that it is racist.
Yeah.
But it does believe that racism is a bad thing. People who wear the Confederate flag are bad people.
Yeah.
In a way that I think, is quite quaint.
I mean, the 90s is also the era of Rodney King. It's the era of the refounding of the militia movement. All of these inputs that we would now see as sort of the harbingers of the racial politics of today on the right. But a show that is aired to 10 million people every week and is sort of depicting a sort of simple American conservative image of moral clarity and goodness, that its politics are explicitly like, being racist is bad. There's no nuancing. You're just a racist if you're racist. It's just, even if naively, I look at that and I think, maybe our racial conversation hasn't necessarily gotten that much better.
Right.
It's gotten better amongst progressives. We have a much more detailed understanding of the way in which racism operates and stuff. But for people who are sort of conservative and looking for conservative media to consume, would the sort of didactic anti-racism of Walker be better than what you'd find on YouTube? Probably.
Yeah. I think for all of its limitations, I'd rather have that as our starting point.
I would just recall all of us back to the principles of the Chuck Norris system. Among them, I will look for good in all people and make them feel worthwhile. If I have nothing good to say about a person, I will say nothing. And I will maintain an attitude of open-mindedness.
Pretty good.
That's certainly better than outright goons or weird racists on YouTube or whatever.
Well, and again, like where it doesn't go is all of the contradictions. It wants to do well. It just has no actual understanding of anything.
I think that's kind of its realism in a weird way.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. That's why I think it's valuable, too. I mean, I know people who believe this stuff, or I grew up with those people who I think there's a tendency on the left sometimes to say that all right wing people are the Chris Rufos.
Thank God they're not.
No, thank God they're not. I mean, for many reasons, but like there's an idea that like everyone is trying to kind of pull one over on you. And what they really say is hidden in their secret little hand signals or whatever that they're going to give you. And
yes,
that's true for some people. But for many, they do just genuinely believe this stuff. And I think Walker is just the ultimate example of that. Like, it's not trying to pull one over on you. It just believes this stuff.
And my sort of naive position on this matter is that it's not a bad thing to make people feel good about believing in principle in anti-racism.
Yeah.
You know, Walker makes it feel good to be on the side of people who hate Confederate gang members.
Just in the past week or two, we learned that Rod Dreher's father was in the KKK.
Right.
And Rod, like, very publicly grappled with this. And I was thinking while watching some of this, like, there's a certain naivety to Rod's racial consciousness or something where he's like, how could my dad be in the KKK if in his position as, like, running the sanitation department in the town Rod grew up in, he made sure that untold numbers of African-American kids had clean water.
Right.
And X, Y, or Z, right? Like that kind of never going deeper just kind of having this kind of jumble of mantras and platitudes and moral kind of rules, just kind of jostled together and never really going deeper, that almost naive, how could my father do X and Y?
Right.
Right. Like, I thought of that example because of, again, the kind of surface level, not always objectionable, of course, moral lessons of the show.
You know, in Rod's defense, at least he thinks it's a problem he has to wrestle with, you know?
Oh, yeah.
He has a sort of naive anti-racist politics as a first principle, which, encountering the contradictions that inevitably exist in American history and in an American family, he has to then go, wait a second, what's the deal? And we may not think that his conclusions are really sufficient, or that they are affecting his behavior or his allegiances sufficiently, but it's better than nothing. Or it's better than permanent rationalization, you know?
The last few things I'll say about this Halloween episode, I mean, there's a part where Walker deputizes a karate teacher to help round up Satanists.
Yeah, but he's really good at karate.
Also, there's one line where they imply that the FBI is just monitoring all phone calls.
The FBI is distributing these photos and these flyers, monitoring all the phone lines.
Well, they definitely have a log of all Satanists, of known Satanists.
Well, they do go around at one point and interview Satanists who they have the record of.
And this is a list of all the individuals arrested or suspected of Satanist activity in the Metroplex in the past 10 years.
I have something to say about this. It's a little bit of a stretch, but I don't think it'll take that long. Because, okay, there's scenes with the Satanists where they're literally just going, Hail Satan! Hail Satan!
Open wide the gates of hell!
My mind, when I hear that, goes to the Mountain Goats song, the best ever death metal band out of Denton. It ends with John Darnielle saying, Hail Satan, Hail Satan, Hail Satan tonight.
Hail Satan. Hail Satan tonight.
What it's about is these kids who start a death metal band and put pentagrams and stuff on their, like, guitars. And then it's implied that one of them gets sent to, like, a, like, mental hospital because he's accused of, like, Satanism. And it's just, it's this kind of this song about indicting adults and authorities for assuming that anybody who's weird and an outsider is a Satanist. And the episode, two things. One is that there's a moment where one of the cops, the good cops in Walker's universe, says something like, well, I think maybe these Satanists are just bad people who want an excuse to do bad things, you know, be crazy, which is like the opposite of the message of the Mountain Goat song, which is saying, like, sometimes people look weird, but they're just weird.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And the hilarious thing, because I was already thinking about this, is that when they are zeroing in on the cemetery where the kids have been abducted and are being held in this, like, crypt, it's a 10-mile radius around Denton.
Whoa.
I mean, it's only like a personal headcanon experience for me. But it's like the message of the episode is, like, Satanists are real. People who look weird are probably Satanists.
Yeah.
There's a magic shop where people hang out, and they're all punks and criminals in hoods.
Well, and the main witch is hot for Walker.
Yeah, well, she's okay, but the other ones are bad. I you know, would love if John Darnielle would watch this episode and write a follow-up song about it.
Come on the pod, please, John. I mean, I was sort of thinking as we were talking, like, why this episode, which is something I grappled with, because it is just a silly episode. Like, of course, it's just, it's quite dumb. And the main reason I thought of it right away is, of course, the satanic panic is ever with us, seemingly. But the thing I came back to, and I said this, and I think in the email I wrote to you guys when we first started planning this episode, I said, given the chance to depict the world as they think it is, the creators of this show basically depict a world that is full of horrors, variously cultural, political, and supernatural. And I think that the value of this episode is that it treats this issue with the same seriousness as crooked cops, pollution.
Yeah.
It is all the same level of intensity. It's not like, hey, folks, here's a Halloween episode. It's going to be kind of funny. Obviously, this isn't real, but, you know, what if it were? It's like, no, you know, sometimes we beat up drug dealers. That's a real problem. Sometimes we have to fight Satanists. Also a real problem. It's all part of the same issue.
Well, and to maybe close the loop, and that sort of episodic quality of the show, that at the end of each episode, except for you know, two-parters, which happen every once in a while, everything has to be resolved. Like, order has to be restored.
Yeah.
Whether that means they killed some Satanists and some children are, like, permanently traumatized, or they stopped a drug ring or whatever. In this episode, Alex was kidnapped and barely not murdered by a person who thinks that he's the, literally the son of the devil. And at the end of the episode is just kicking back, having a drink with Walker at the bar, on to the next thing. There's no therapy in this show.
No, no. Well, I mean, and that's the least of what she's been through. The one of the recurring villains on the show, one of the only recurring villains, is a man named LaRue.
Oh, yeah. She's haunted by LaRue.
Yeah. Anytime the show kind of lags, they let him out of prison and he can assault her again, basically.
The liberal judges let him out of prison.
There is an episode, I want to say, where there's a technicality involved, which kind of leads us to the next episode. The third episode we watch is one called Harm's Way. The reason I included this one is just that it's kind of the most straightforward Walker.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's not that much to say about it. It's a bunch of people who have been hired to carry out murders, but they like wear Halloween costumes and they just love torturing and killing people. It's very thin blue line. Like, this is the world. If it weren't for us, you would just be getting murdered and tortured and given up to Satan.
Smile.
Turn this old bird inside out.
One of my favorite things to do, especially in like 90s era movies and television, is like spot actors or actresses I know, right, from like random weird roles. And the villain in this episode was played by the psychoanalyst who Elaine dates in Seinfeld.
Oh my God.
Yes, yes.
And it's one of my favorite episodes because Kramer pretends to be dating Elaine and then goes into the shrink's office and is like, I'd take a cappuccino. And he's like, this is an office. How do you think you can get a cappuccino? And yeah, it's just, it's one of the most bizarre and, you know, strange Seinfeld episodes.
All the Walker episodes are perfect for people who want to rack their brain trying to figure out how you know a sort of villain's face from.
Maybe that's a good segue to The Principal.
Yes.
Another season 6 episode, because the main villain in this one, a character who is called Keith Bolt, he's this high school teacher and turns out a kind of ringleader of local drug dealers, right? You know, using some of his students to, you know, sell drugs for him.
You okay, Danny? I don't have to worry about you, do I?
What do you mean?
You haven't been making your quota lately.
That character, he is played by the same actor who is in Sex and the City, one of Samantha Jones's main love interests, the hotel magnate Richard Wright.
Oh, that's right. Thank you, Matt, for placing that for me.
And I will just say a little bit of a Know Your Enemy Easter egg. The mayor from our very first Know Your Enemy film club, the mayor who is locked up for saying Merry Christmas, appears in a Walker episode too as a out-of-control ex-Marine.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, this is a coherent universe.
Same cinematic universe, yeah.
I did want to mention one other thing at the start of our discussion of The Principal, which is that this episode begins with a montage of a shirtless Walker working out.
And a song, too.
Working man, you're working it to the
What I realized was what he's working out on by this point in the late 90s, that is the total gym that he would hawk on TV all the time.
Of course.
But I also wanted to just say, this is not the only product placement for Walker Texas Ranger.
That's a good point, Matt. This is a major thing about this show.
The biggest example is the Dodge trucks.
The Dodge Ram.
And famously, Dodge trucks, Dodge vehicles are always driven by the good guys in Walker, and Chevys and other vehicles are driven by the bad guys. That's like a rule in Walker.
That's so great.
A minor aside, I'll just say, I watched a lot of episodes to pick the right ones for us to watch, and the same way that David Lynch can shoot like a ceiling fan in a way that is really horrifying, nobody makes semi-trucks look scarier than Walker Texas Ranger. Like, there are so many episodes that just have these psychotic scenes of trucks barreling down the highway and usually being driven by a drug addict or something. It's really some psychosexual truck thing going on.
Trucks giveth and trucks taketh.
Speaking of psychosexual, this is my favorite Walker episode. I mean, it's the best of the best.
It was my favorite that I watched. Honestly, Jesse, this is such a pure undistilled presentation of 90s era, what would you call them?
Motivational assembly.
Assemblies. Yeah.
Because we mentioned this is about a high school teacher using students to deal drugs. He kills the principal who kind of discovers this drug ring.
Walker's friend.
Walker's friend who is working out with him.
Come on, Max. You can do it. Last one. Welcome back.
That's good to be back, I think. I tell you, that high school is keeping me awfully busy, though.
Yeah, how's it going down there?
You know, Walker, I've been principal at Burroughs for 3 years now. We've been battling drugs that whole time. This last 6 months, it's gotten worse than it's ever been.
Then eventually this principal gets killed.
All right, boys, give me the drugs. I'm turning all of you in.
You're not gonna do anything, except die.
And I guess this is one thing Texas Rangers can do. this blew my mind.
Yeah.
Walker poses as a special principal sent to the school by
the governor.
Yeah, the governor, the state board of education, whatever it might be. And Trevette, his sidekick, is the assistant principal.
Yeah, just by edict. They just show up and he's now the principal.
Yes. And we might as well get to just the most mind-blowing, amazing aspect of this episode, which is, so we mentioned the drug problem. And at some point, Walker goes,
but I was thinking about having an assembly.
An assembly? Oh, the last two assemblies were disasters. We couldn't even...
I think I know how to get their attention. Thank you.
And we even see the kids at the start of the assembly kind of fucking around, being jackasses, throwing stuff.
And think about listeners, when you would have to go to an assembly and it was unannounced and you're like, what the hell is this going to be? You're ready to make fun of it. The whole point of an assembly as a child, right, as a kid in high school, is that you have to find a way for it to be hilariously funny and not have its message actually reach you. And these high school students are in that mindset. But what they see on stage.
The lights go down, the smoke comes out, the music starts to pump, the kids are immediately rapt as who should enter the auditorium but none other than the Power Team.
Hell yeah.
What is the Power Team, you ask? It is a group of gigantic men in tights and workout clothes who do feats of strength while telling you to get your life straightened out.
We're here today to motivate you, to encourage you, inspire you, not about being a world-class athlete, but about being a world-class person. Barry Hanley, 6'7", 325 pounds, two-time national AAU wrestling champion, will be crushing close to 4 feet of concrete with each of his arms.
Yeah.
Yes. Former athletes, power lifters, a whole assortment. And what we're describing is up on stage, people karate chopping, 10 cinder blocks with each arm. Or I think my favorite was bending the horseshoe into the shape of a heart.
Oh, that was so beautiful.
Snapping two baseball bats over your knee. Just breaking shit the whole time. Being like, you can get your life together.
Aaron Bell, standing 6'1", 260 pounds, two-time military powerlifting champion. Football, baseball star with the 22-inch biceps and 32-inch waist. We're trying to drive his elbow through this wall of ice. Aaron Bell.
The best was the finale of the first. For some reason, there's fucking three assemblies.
There's three. Because the kids just need another dose. It's not hitting yet.
Right. Walker uses weird terminology associated with vaccines. He's they need a booster. It was very strange.
He's inoculating them against the appeal of drugs and peer pressure.
And I think it's the first assembly that ends with kind of the main guy from the Power Team.
John Jacobs.
He's handcuffed. And then it's the big kind of punchline is...
sometimes they're... drug dealers are looked up to because they have a wad of cash or maybe some gold chains or a sports car in the parking lot or an old pretty girlfriend. But don't be fooled, my friend. In 5 years, they'll either be dead, in a crack house, or in prison. They're users. And I want to challenge you to recognize who the users are in this school. And today, as I try to break these handcuffs, I'm going to give it everything I've got to snap these chains. But I want to challenge you to snap the chains of your past and realize... the users and the fake friends, you don't need them. They won't be there when you're in trouble. be a dream maker.
And then he snaps the fucking handcuffs off, and it's just like, rah, you know, and everyone, like all the students are enthralled.
And they all stop doing drugs. It becomes a problem for shop teacher Bolt and his gang of miscreant delinquent kids who can no longer sell their drugs because everyone's refusing them because they've been so won over by the power team. There's a great moment where the teacher who is sort of supportive of Walker's initiatives in the school is like, who are these people? And Walker goes,
John Jacobs started the power team about 20 years ago. And their message has saved a lot of kids.
And the power team, of course, are a real group of giant men who...
I could see that. The verisimilitude in this episode was strong.
There was like a Christian version too, right?
Well, they were Christian, but they couldn't do the Christian stuff in schools.
Right.
But what's so interesting is you can tell they're Christian watching it.
Yes.
There is like a step missing in their spiel. They're like, these handcuffs take 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch to break, and you can get your life back on track too. And like, that's kind of it.
The abracadabra is the Lord Jesus Christ, and they don't
right,
ever
exactly.
say it.
It's missing the altar call, right?
Yeah.
When you surrender your life to Christ and are empowered by the Holy Spirit, then you would really be able to break some fucking cinder blocks or, you know, break out of some handcuffs or whatever.
It goes without saying, the kids see this assembly and they're just completely blown away. I mean, rapturous applause. Everyone loves it. They didn't know you could not do drugs. They didn't know that big men could break things. Now they don't want to do drugs anymore. My favorite part, that I was just on in stitches, even though I've seen this episode probably 10 times, showing it to various people, the last feat of strength they do at the end of the episode, where they're celebrating, basically having solved all the problems, they have like a celebration assembly, and the last feat of strength is two of the power team members blow up with their mouths hot water bottles.
That was so bizarre.
It's obscene.
They look like giant testicles.
Yeah, they look like just giant swollen balls. And they pop. They blow them up till they pop. And it's really gross.
Yeah, totally. All the previous feats of strength had been like roughly the kind of thing I'd seen before in that sort of presentation, right? Like cinder blocks, bending metal. That part of it was just very strange. It's like, and now we're going to demonstrate people with the most powerful lung capacity in the world. You know, like people are like, what?
Also, like, I mean, it just makes explicit one of the underlying themes of Walker, which is that strength is moral. Walker is a good fighter in part because he's a good man. And Trivette, it should be said, while Trivette is being the assistant principal, his whole role in this episode is to round up the ne'er-do-well kids and to make them do laps and push-ups, which also gets them on track. Uh-huh.
Well, this part of conservative manhood might be continuous because we've got all the deadlifting conservative men at this point.
Right, yeah.
The gym going... Bronze Age pervert type. But, you know, I mean, in keeping with the sort of non-continuity, this is not Bronze Age pervert style masculinity. Well, okay, there's not an acknowledgement of the perversity on display, at least.
No. Something else in the Walker hierarchy that comes through in this episode is Walker eventually, of course, faces down with the terrible teacher, Mr. Knob, or whatever, Mr. Bolt. There's one kid in Mr. Bolt's drug dealing gang who's the good kid. He's like the one who is, the rest of them are just troublemakers. And there's one kid who wants out. And because he wants out, Mr. Bolt tries to kill him, basically. And he takes him to the roof. And Mr. Bolt is getting ready to throw this kid off the roof. Walker comes up on the roof. And of course, for all of his best intentions to try to help the kids through the power team, at the end of the day, you do need a daddy to come and kick ass.
Bolt!
Let him go. I said, let him go.
Yeah.
And Walker can't ever really be threatened without good reason. He has to always easily win, unless the show goes out of its way to say why it's even a question. And in this case, it's because...
I was a Navy SEAL, and I make sure the kids know it. I saw the way you handled yourself in the schoolyard yesterday. What were you?
Marine.
Well, Marine and a SEAL.
So the show, the show, it has to stress that, like, this is only a fight because he's a SEAL. And SEALs are respectable.
Yes, exactly. And so it's like Navy SEAL versus Marine on the roof.
Well, Marine, looks like I'm going to have to throw you off with the kid.
I'm a Texas Ranger, Bolt. And you're under arrest.
Texas Ranger, huh? Well, you're still going off the roof.
I mean, not to give the end away, but I will. You know, as you might be shocked to learn, it was a final roundhouse kick from Walker that ends up pushing Mr. Bolt over the
side of a building.
Yeah, over the side of the building, and he falls to his death. Yeah, it's
pretty rough.
It's pretty explicit.
The child who has been cowering on the roof and was about to be thrown to his death gives a like way too convincing performance.
Oh yeah.
And Chuck Norris can't emote. Walker just kind of puts his arm around him and walks him downstairs.
He killed Mr. Henson. Right in front of all of us.
Okay, son. Let's go.
I'm sorry.
There's a funny esoteric reading.
Please.
Of the encounter between Bolt and Walker, which is that it is known from something I read on the internet that the original name for Walker, his name was going to be Bolt.
Oh, interesting.
Which, if you don't know that, then it's not interesting. But the fact that he's a Navy SEAL,
yeah,
that he's just almost just as powerful as him, but he's literally pure evil. He's the opposite character. Like, he is, you know, if we want to say it's like Walker doing battle against the Antichrist, you could see that here.
That's a really good point.
This is where, like I said this earlier, that the bad guys in the show are always like just so bad. Like, this guy is selling probably like cocaine in a high school.
Yeah.
Like, he could just be like a very low moral quality, but not necessarily someone who's going to murder a principal in front of a bunch of kids.
Yeah. Snaps his neck.
Yeah. Snaps his neck and then threaten their lives if they stop selling drugs. Like, this guy is the embodiment of pure anarchic evil, because Bolt is an authority figure, right? And he's meant to be like a saving grace for these kids, because this continuation program is like, these are all delinquent kids who would have been kicked out of the school if they didn't do the SHOP program. So he's does this kind of stuff that Walker does, but takes advantage of them for his own purposes. And then the other thing is that there's a moment, it's so brief, but when he's holding the kid like over the edge of the building in the final scene, he says something to him like,
"Only the strong succeed, Danny. They thrive on adversity."
But it's basically like a Nietzschean will to power thing.
Yeah.
He's saying, like, if you can kill someone to get your way, then you win. Then that's your morality. Mm-hmm. And Walker is not that, you know?
Yeah.
He's the opposite of that. He's like, yes, you use power and violence, but only to protect the innocent and the good, and to preserve some kind of moral clarity that's imperiled by the chaotic evil out in the world.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that. The kind of ratcheting up of Mr. Bolt's evilness. It was the same thing in the Halloween episode, right? It couldn't just be like Satanists trying to do a black mass somewhere, or like causing mayhem in a graveyard. It had to be like, no, they're gathering like a ton of kids from this one town for like a ritualistic murder. You know, it just has to be the most extreme and absurd. Or even, you know, this last episode we're talking about, the principal. My sense was, they never mentioned, I don't think, what drug they're selling.
It looks like cocaine.
Exactly. Yeah, when I was going to say, when the principal who gets his neck snapped for, you know, walking in on this meeting of Mr. Bolt kind of distributing the drugs for people to sell. Like, the baggies full of white powder, I mean, if it was cocaine, it'd be like unbelievable amounts of money, right? Like, man, this guy is really running quite the operation here.
And that simple black and white is so the core of this show. Like, if you're a drug dealer, you are a psychopath. You're someone who loves the idea of children losing their mind on drugs.
Yeah,
both evil and good are pure in this show.
Yeah.
And so all the kind of like ambiguities and, you know, strangely mixed quality of human beings in our lives, and, you know, the old Solzhenitsyn line, the line between good and evil runs through every human heart. No, it runs through Chuck Norris and whoever he's about to roundhouse kick.
Also, fundamentally, everything is personal. There are no systems in Walker. There are no structures.
Right,
the CEO who's bad is a bad person. If it were a different CEO, that would be fine. And there's a good episode where the Lynn sisters, the real life sort of B-list country celebrities, the Lynn sisters, make an appearance. and they are abducted by gangsters, I think, who are going to force them to record a new album that they can bootleg.
Oh,
they
wow.
do so. I'm sorry I didn't rip that one for you guys. We should watch that one next time. But it takes something that is systemic or that is known, like bootlegging music, and it personalizes that into there's like a gangster who's going to take these two women to a house, lock them in the house, make them record a new album that they can then rip onto burned CDs and sell on the black market. Everything's personal. If we could just get all the bad people off the street, then we'd be fine.
I mean, Jesse, that's such an important point. Listeners might remember, longtime listeners, one of our very early episodes with Max Alvarez about kind of working class conservatism. And, you know, one of the things that I've really taken away from thinking about that over the years and thinking about my own life is the kind of advice Chuck Norris would give a young person who's troubled isn't necessarily bad, right?
Yeah.
Like, think about the personal yeah. code I mentioned. Like, is it bad to love your family or look for the good in people or, yeah. you know, be open-minded or loyal to your family and friends? No, of course not. But just like, you know, you wouldn't tell an individual, you're a young person, you want to be successful, you really should do a lot of drugs, be irresponsible, right? You wouldn't say that to anyone. But all that can be true, and it'd still be insufficient to understand the structures and forces that intervene in our lives and that include some of these problems that Walker, Texas Ranger is trying to solve.
You and know? In an interesting way, it does have an oddly clear eye on certain things. Like racism, like it does basically just say yeah. some people are racist. It doesn't go into more thinking about how they got that way. It basically just says, yeah, some people are racist.
Yeah, and they shouldn't be.
And that is, in its own way, almost more deep than, like, again, what you would see now with this, which is like, well, that's not really racist.
Or don't they have a right to be racist because this other thing happened?
And its lack of depth can lead it humorously astray, but also sometimes make it surprisingly straightforward.
Yeah, it's better to, in one sense, not explain why someone's racist in Walker, Texas Ranger than nowadays to say they're racist because they had a horrible woke high school teacher,
right?
Who
right.
made them read Toni Morrison, right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll just say is that, like, make no mistake, for all you can say about this show and for its surprising nuance on certain issues, it fundamentally puts forward a world view that is militaristic, where police are the ultimate authority and where the answer to most problems is to get strong and to fight for your country. That is ultimately mm-hmm. what it believes in at the end of the day, is just like, yeah, when in doubt, join the military, fight, you know, fight the right way, fight the right people, trust the police, respect the police. Like, that's its ultimate worldview. But within that, there is a surprising, I don't want to say open-mindedness, but like the episode with the Satanists has the weird little side thing where like the woman who runs the witch shop is into Walker and the show is kind of into her.
Wow. Hello, handsome.
It's like she's kind of yeah. cool. So it's interesting because it's scared, it's bigoted, it's shallow, it's stupid. And even so, it sort of feels oddly nuanced compared to what we see today.
I think it's just American. It's
right.
just like extremely American, for better and for worse. Like, it just has that mixture of a naivete that's noxious and a naivete that's admirable. The mixture of like power as something that can be used to instantiate good values and power as a thing that inevitably corrupts. Like, it has all the sort of contradictions of the kind of American project. And it's like just an cultural product of this particular moment in American history too, which was this like weird mixture of like hopeful and adrift, like confident and doubting and confused and uncertain about the future. And so whether that is fascist or just American, it's a question that our listeners have always been and will continue to do a good job wrestling with.
And I will say too that it just feels so appropriate that it ended in 2001. I can't imagine it in the post 9/11 world, really. And Chuck Norris very quickly becomes a meme.
Well, the Conan bit depends on the idea that like this show that was on just 3 years before, that finished just 3 years before, feels so weird and funny and out of place.
And overly earnest.
Yeah, and overly earnest. It's just a testament to how much time passed in those 3 years.
Yeah. Sam, I don't know if you remember this, but way back when we were basically talking about, you know, country music, but included in that was my long review essay about Ken Burns's PBS documentary on country music, right? And I thought it was so telling that that basically wraps up before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm just struck by, you know, like when you're thinking about American culture, you know, our music, our television, our movies, I think there's a reason some narratives kind of stopped before 9/11 because it was so disruptive and different and unleashed maybe energies that were there before, but allows them to surface in a new way. It's just a lot to take in.
Yeah.
You know, everything that happened after that, you know, the 20 some years after that, were just, you know, to assimilate them into a broader narrative is difficult, I think.
And I think especially when those things are sort of examples of Americana as such, because Americana comes to be so kind of tainted by the war on terror in the years immediately after 2001. Uh-huh. So you can kind of maintain this different kind of concept of the American cultural fabric before it happens.
I mean, I think Walker is all about the heartland. It's about Texas. Anything important is happening in Texas.
It was filmed in Texas.
Yeah, it makes prominent use of the horrible street scenes of Dallas. Even though, of course, you'd imagine Walker would be champing at the bit to take on terrorists. It's almost like that. It just doesn't resonate in that way.
No.
There is an episode where an Irish terrorist comes.
Oh, nice. Oh, we should watch that one.
I'm telling you, there are just too many. There are too many great episodes to choose from.
Well, listeners, if you enjoyed this, let us know. And I'm sure Jesse will curate another set of these the next time we need a break from the actual serious, terrible conservative world that we normally have to wade into on this show.
And I would add, sometimes playfully, sometimes less so, we might be accused of attending too much to the high-level intellectual products of conservative intellectuals. And next time we're accused of that, I am going to just link to this episode.
I'm just here cleaning out the grease trap in the fryer. Just like, here's some disgusting garbage for us to go through.
The grease trap in the fryer of the American imagination. Well, thanks, Jesse.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for giving us all the opportunity to do this, and thanks to the listeners for bearing with.
Yeah, never again, but okay, thanks.
All right, catch you next time, listeners. Thank you.
Bye.